We're talking about agriculture issues on National Ag Day. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're home to 68,500 farms here in Wisconsin, and they sit on 14.3 million acres. Farmers, let's hear from you. How are your farm operations doing? What would you like to tell the secretary designee about the situation on your family farm? We're at 800-642-1234. Brad Paff is the secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. He previously worked for U.S. Representative Ron Kind and also oversaw the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Farm Service Agency. Secretary Paff, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here, Kate. It's a tremendous honor. And good morning to all the hardworking men and women right now who are in our dairy barns, our milking parlors, feeding our young stock.
Well, you know exactly where we find them each morning, for sure. We've heard some cows listen to us, and we appreciate that. So you've worked a few different roles in the agriculture industry. You previously were Wisconsin Executive Director of the Farm Service Agency. How will your experience enable you to serve the needs of Wisconsin farmers?
Well, thank you for that question. Wisconsin family farmers are extremely hardworking, resilient, dedicated individuals. But over the last 4 years, they've experienced extremely low prices on all commodities, may it be organic or may it be conventional. And first thing I just want to say is this, is that I'm from the farm. My family have been farmers since they came to this country in the late 1800s. And I understand the way of life. I understand the dedication. I understand the work ethic. I understand the identity. And I'm going to listen. The most important thing I can do is listen. The most important thing I can do is let people know that I am an advocate, that I will hear their concerns, I will share their concerns with legislators in the state capitol, with the governor and the governor's senior leadership team, and with our federal policymakers. I'm going to do everything I can in order to make sure that those men and women that are out there right now milking those cows and feeding the young stock know that they have an advocate. They need that. They deserve that.
And you were going to talk about suppressed prices here in a moment. You were nominated for the job of Secretary of the Department of Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection in December. And what have you prioritized and accomplished in the past few months on the job?
I think the most important thing that we can do is we need to recognize the fact of how important agriculture, particularly dairy, is to this state. Agriculture provides an $88 billion annual economic impact to this state. Dairy alone makes up over $43 billion of that $88 billion annually. One out of every nine jobs in this state is tied to agriculture, either directly or indirectly. It is extremely important that all people in this state, all 5.7 million people in this state, recognize how important agriculture is, not just economically, not just for the food that that gets put on our table, but also what it means to our state when it comes to who we are, our heritage, our culture. And for those of us that drive cars, on our license plate, it says America's Dairyland. That's a tremendous statement, but that's a statement of pride. That's also a statement demonstrating of who we are as a people of a state. And I just want individuals to know that my number one priority is to make sure that we can keep our dairy industry and our agriculture industry strong. I want to find markets. Those markets may be local markets, farmers markets, CSAs. They may be national, international markets. Just 2 weeks ago, we here at the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection had a team of individuals over in the Middle East, in Dubai, promoting Wisconsin agriculture products. The people of this world want Wisconsin agriculture products because there's value in that, not just the high-quality, nutritious food that people have the opportunity to put on their table at a very, very affordable price, but also they know the hard work that comes with that product. That's more than just a commodity. There's a story behind what's on the dinner table, and there's a story behind that, what's in that glass of milk.
Yeah.
there's a story. There's a story of people and a story of communities.
Well, let's get to some of those stories. Let's go to Owen now, joining us from Waiwega. Hi, Owen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Owen.
I want to take this platform and be heard, and hopefully this is going to, I'm going to get receive some good feedback from all the listeners regarding this topic. I'm a young beginning dairy farmer in the state of Wisconsin. I own cattle. I own some equipment. I have good credit. I've continually been denied financing through the USDA. I've got a Greenstone Farm credit as well, trying to get financing. Because I do not have a secure milk market for my milk, and I am employed on another larger farm, I am not been given the opportunity to borrow money and continue to invest in land and capital to become an owner of my own entity as a dairy farm owner. And that has become a real issue for me because I'm stuck working for lower wages for other people who, to be honest with you, I work 7 days a week. I work very hard, and I help this farm out tremendously with the work that I do. We're farming because we like cows. We actually enjoy the work, and we like the animals.
And Owen, I want to stop you right there because I see what you're headed at, I think. Why is borrowing really difficult for young farmers who want to get in the business?
Well, Owen brings up an extremely important point. There are a number of young people that want to enter farming. I have heard that from my travels over the last 2 months that I've been in this position. People want to farm. They want to get more involved in agriculture. So providing lending opportunities, the United States Department of Agriculture Farm Service Agency, as Owen referred to, as well as our private lending institutions, when it comes to agriculture credit, Wisconsin obviously has a very strong credit rating. The last 4 years of low commodity prices have made it very difficult on the balance sheets. I would like to learn more, obviously, of what is happening there with Owen. I can say that we here at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, we have within our farm center and with our Division of Agriculture Development, do have a team of individuals that may be able to assist when it comes to trying to secure a permanent place for the milk that Owen's farm is producing. So, again, the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection and our Division of Agriculture Development is some place that I would encourage Owen to reach out to.
But
that number real quickly is 1-800-942-2474.
And we'll have that on our show page at WPR.org. I'm wondering, though, is it even feasible to get young farmers into the business who don't have a history of agriculture, who don't have other resources, land and so forth, and the combines?
Well, that's a very good question, and I will say the answer is yes. And I'm going to draw an example to the Governor Evers' 2019-2021 biennial budget. And he recognizes the fact that there's a number of individuals that seek to enter agriculture, to enter farming. And again, agriculture can be very, very, capital dependent. But there are lower cost methods. There is funding that's been proposed in the governor's budget when it comes to programs like grazing, which provides a lower cost path in order to enter into agriculture.
And we're going to get to the governor's budget in just a minute. We're talking with Brad Paff. He's secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. And you have a line to him at 800-642-1234. What would you like to prioritize? And what do you see in Governor Evers' budget impacting farmers? Join in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll continue the conversation with him in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's National Ag Day. We're talking with DATCAP Secretary Designee Brad Paff here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin farmers are planning for the future of their businesses facing some serious economic headwinds. We lost 638 dairy farms last year, and that was really an unprecedented rate of nearly two a day. Most were small operations unable to survive milk prices. Have you had trouble finding buyers for your milk, cheese, or cranberries? Has agriculture oversupply had an impact on your family farm? Is your farm financially stable? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Brad Paff is the secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Brad, we lost hundreds of dairy farms last year, many of them small or moderate-sized herds. What is plaguing dairy farmers, and will we see that hemorrhage in 2019? Oh, I'm sorry, and Brad is apparently not with us right now. We just lost him on the line. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Don now, joining us from Trempealeau. Hi, Don.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious. Secretary-elect Papp just suggested that somehow DADCAP could create a permanent milk market for a producer. And I'm wondering how that can happen. I'm not aware the state of Wisconsin can provide any permanent milk market.
And Don, where do you work? What is your situation? Do you work on a farm?
No, I actually work for a capital equipment company providing equipment to dairy farmers.
What have those dairy farmers been telling you about their situation?
Everybody knows that the economy in general is depressed, and milk price has been depressed for an extended period of time. So they're struggling. Even the very efficient ones are barely able to make a margin, and the ones that haven't been able to become super efficient are losing equity.
Do you think providing some type of permanent stability, perhaps what they do in Canada on price fixing, might have an impact?
Well, I think Canadians would have trouble with calling it price fixing. I think we should look at all the options that are out there. I don't know that that's necessarily a solution for our market, but we should look for all the options.
Well, let's bring the secretary into this. We lost you there for a moment. Have you back? Don, in Trempealeau, works for an equipment maker supplying dairy farmers, and was wondering about how do you give more stability to the market?
Well, without a doubt, price stability and price uncertainty is one of the biggest concerns that we have in agriculture at this given time. We have a 31-member task force that was put together by former Governor Scott Walker and the UW System President Ray Cross. That group is meeting tomorrow on Friday, March 15th in Sheboygan to hear over 51 recommendations that have been brought forward, and some of those dealing with both federal and state issues. What can be done in order to address a number of issues, including the instability and the overall vitality of the dairy industry. Some of those proposals have been brought forward by those in the dairy industry do talk about what can we do at the federal level when it comes to pricing of milk, but what also can be done at the state level when it comes to issues around dairy research and dairy innovation. Consumer demand is constantly changing, but one of the things that's very clear, and that is that people seek dairy in their diet. We here in Wisconsin are very well equipped in order to meet the changing consumer demands. But again, the demands continue to keep changing as far as what the consumers seek.
Secretary, last year we saw an unprecedented 638 dairy farms go belly up. Will that hemorrhaging continue in 2019? What are you seeing, and what is going to stop it?
Well, there's continuing exiting of the dairy industry. Our milk production is staying steady or increasing. We're continuing to be a national leader when it comes to cheese production and other dairy products. But without a doubt, we are seeing individuals exit the industry, and that is having an impact on our rural communities. What can be done to stop that? There's a number of things that can be done. Most important thing that we need to do is we need to make sure that we have market opportunities. I mentioned earlier the importance of markets. We have to be able to have products available locally with all new markets, may it be farmers markets, CSAs, the local regional markets, to the international marketplace. We must be able to participate in all of those. Farmers need markets for their products. I will do everything I can here at the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection to find those markets. Farmers also need to be able to generate income from that farm from different products or commodities. And I know a number of different farmers, obviously, in addition to producing high-quality milk, also, obviously, are in the beef market or in the grain market as well.
Well, let's transition now to another market. Let's go to Chris now in Adams with the question. Chris, hi.
Good morning. I would like to talk about hemp.
Yes.
I have two autoimmune diseases, and I would like to raise a patch. I have a significant yard. I would like to raise a patch of industrial hemp in my backyard to juice and manufacture my own CBD oil. Now, I'm confused about the law, and I suspect everybody is a little bit at this point. I found out that you guys have an office of hemp. So I called to find out what I have to do because I already talked to my local authorities, and they said, well, you probably have to get a permit. So nobody got back to me from your office, and I understand that I have missed the deadline, which I think is silly to begin with.
Well, and Chris, I have to stop you there because we're short on time. What is the process of growing industrial hemp?
Well, there's tremendous interest in this state in hemp. Wisconsin has historically been a state that has grown hemp in the past. Up until a little after World War II, we were one of the national leaders when it came to hemp for a variety of different industrial products. Now there's a lot of interest as far as hemp for the various the oil that can come from hemp. This past year in 2019, for the upcoming 2019 growing season, we've had close to 1,500 applications from growers and a little over 700 applications from processors that are seeking enter the hemp, growing hemp or processing hemp for this 2019 growing season.
Do you see this crop to be perhaps a silver lining for the state's agriculture industry?
I think that any time that we can give farmers opportunities in order to try and bring more income to the farm, I think that's a good idea.
Well, we still have just a few minutes here left on the phone, but I want to get to the issue of clean drinking water, which the governor has declared this year. Research has found that in some parts of the state, nitrate contamination in wells can be tied to animal waste, and the issue sometimes gets set up as farmers versus environmentalists. What can your department do on the issue of water contamination?
We're all in this together. We need to have a balanced approach when it comes to this. We have to have everyone at the table. Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, we will be at that table. We will make sure that, obviously, we will work with our partners. We will work with private landowners. We'll work with farmers. We're going to work with our county and town governments. We're going to make sure that everyone is at the table. I just quickly want to share the fact that I think that there's ideas, obviously, that can be brought forward at a local level as well in order to, recognize, the different landscapes that we have within our state. Right now, we've got something called a producer-led watershed protection program. In the governor's 2019-2021 biennial budget, he's seeking to increase that. That is something that we bring all partners together. Remember, we always need to remember the strength and the diversity of thoughts that we have in this state. But water is important to all of us. The governor has declared 2019 the year of clean drinking water. Let's never forget the fact that three out of our state's four borders are made up of water, from the north in Lake Superior to the east in Lake Michigan, and obviously in the west with the Mississippi River and the St. Croix River.
Well, very quickly here, chronic wasting disease. I want to get your take on this. DACAP works with the DNR to monitor and regulate. There has been some back and forth on the rules in place to combat chronic wasting disease. What do you know? What can DACAP do about this issue?
Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection works closely with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We will continue to work closely on this to make sure that we can combat this disease, that this disease does not spread, that we can continue to keep, obviously, joy and enthusiasm that many of us have when it comes to the fall and our outdoor hunt. We need to make sure, obviously, that people can have confidence that, when they have the opportunity to enjoy the great outdoors and go hunting.
Secretary Paff, thank you for joining us. Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection with us there, Brad Paff. He previously worked for U.S. Representative Ron Kind and also oversaw Department of Agriculture's Farm Service Agency. Up next, we look at the two crashes of the Boeing jets. You're with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the grounding of Boeing jets across the world and what that means for air travel. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What we know now is that the flight recorders, which are those black boxes from Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302, they've arrived in Paris this morning, and that the investigation into why that Boeing 737 MAX 8 plane went down Sunday is in a real crucial phase right now as we learn those cockpit conversations. What do you want to know about how crash investigations are handled and how the Federal Aviation Administration may reach its conclusions on the safety of Boeing aircraft? We're at 800-642-1234. Seth Kaplan is an aviation journalist with Kaplan Research. Seth, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good to be back, Kate.
So what we know here, two different Boeing 737 MAX 8 jets crashed in the past several months, countries around the world now grounding them, and President Trump joined the world yesterday in grounding these aircraft. Did the president's decision come to you as any surprise?
No, maybe I was surprised that the president was doing it rather than more conventionally sort of the technocrats at the FAA. But the decision, in the end, kind of wasn't really that big of a decision because, as you said, Kate, so many of these planes were grounded around the world, and so much airspace around the world was off limits to them that they're kind of wasn't really much left to do, although obviously that was a big step still, with Boeing agreeing with the FAA that this should happen and not sort of representing it anymore as, hey, this is what everybody else is doing, but the plane's still safe to fly.
How many planes out there are there of these Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft?
There are about 350 flying in the world right now. So that's a very small percentage of the overall global fleet, and a small percentage of all the MAXs that will eventually be flying, assuming that all of this gets worked out and that they are indeed delivered. So, most people, unless you fly very frequently, the odds are you haven't been on one yet, but the odds are good that you'll be on one someday, again, assuming that that everything goes forward.
So this grounding by so many countries is not exactly incapacitating airlines as they try to figure out what planes to replace them with.
It's not. Some airlines obviously have more than others, or more importantly, sort of a bigger percentage of their fleet than others. Just a handful of them at Cayman Airways might be a bigger problem for that airline than 34 of them at Southwest, which is what Southwest has. Southwest has 700 total airplanes. But you're right. Today, if you're flying and your flight is canceled, the odds are still greater that it's canceled for some other reason, weather or just a routine mechanical issue, than because of this. It'll be disruptive. But Southwest, which I mentioned for perspective, some people might recall that in recent weeks they've been canceling a lot of flights, more than 100 flights on some days, because of what seems to be a labor dispute with their mechanics. Southwest accusing them of sort of working to rule too stringently, and they're in a long negotiation there. Anyway, that dispute has resulted some days in more than 100 cancellations. Southwest, I looked at the schedule data. It's a company, Dio, puts out the subscription schedule data. Southwest had 163 flights scheduled today on the MAX. And the thing is that these airlines have some spare aircraft all the time waiting to make up some of the lost capacity when a flight cancels for any reason. Like I said, kind of a routine mechanical thing. So yeah, my math tells me that today will be a messier day than others, especially at airlines like Southwest, American, United to a lesser degree. It has just 13 of these airplanes, but nothing on the order of, let's say, even a snowstorm that can, on a bad day, cancel 1,000 flights. It's
sure.
not going to be anything like that. There are less than 300 MAX flights even scheduled today in the U.S. And again, not all of them will end up canceled.
So, Seth, getting back to this crash, just how similar are they when you look at both of these crashes, Lion Air and the current one, Ethiopian Airlines? Can you draw some similarities, some parallels?
And as the days go on, Kate, the similarities seem to be stronger. You know, when this plane first crashed, Sunday. In the broadest terms, you could see that, well, first of all, two of the same kind of aircraft had crashed. We knew more, of course, about the Lion Air crash because it's been 4.5 months since then. But this one, you know, you knew that there were issues with its vertical climb. You know, as it was taking off, it wasn't the smooth takeoff that most of us would expect. But now, you know, first you had the CEO of Ethiopian indicating that the pilot in his distress call said he had problems controlling the flight. Okay, that sounds a little bit more like what was happening with Lion Air. And now these reports that satellite data, and this is rather new technology, you know, without even having seen the data yet in the black boxes, indicated that, yeah, it was even more similar. So with Lion Air, you know, we know that there was this new system that was actually designed to prevent crashes, to prevent the kinds of things that had caused some famous crashes in the past. And in fact, that system contributed to the crash. Some blame also to go around there. That investigation continues. But, you know, the airline in that case seemed to have put an airplane back in the sky that had this serious issue a day earlier, rather than taking it out of service and fixing it. You know, perhaps the pilots didn't know exactly what to do. This one, you know, none of those kinds of reports that this plane had these particular problems previously. But yeah, as time goes on, it does look more and more similar. We don't know yet that particular system is what caused this, but the suspicions are becoming stronger.
Talking with Seth Kaplan, he's an aviation journalist with Kaplan Research, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad that the U.S. is grounding Boeing's 737 MAX model? Has this situation concerned you to the point where perhaps you've canceled your flight, or do you think that this investigation should play out and that these aircraft should keep flying? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Andy now from Libertyville. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Kate. How are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
So I just had a question. I thought I heard somewhere that the person that President Trump appointed to oversee, you know, aviation for the U.S. came from Boeing, and which is a little concerning considering the fact that the United States was the last country to ground these airplanes. It seems to me that there might be a little, you know, how do you want to say it, I guess, reliance on, you know, corporate America to do the right thing here. And it seems like it might have put safety in jeopardy. And I just wanted to hear what your speaker had to say about that.
Yes, Seth, what do we know about overlaps in the industry versus regulatory control?
Andy asks a good question. You know, there's nothing unusual or by definition wrong with the FAA working closely with manufacturers and airlines. I mean, they have to, right? But then where's the line? And I'm sure there are people looking into that as we speak right now, requesting, you know, making public records requests about the communication between the FAA and Boeing, perhaps airlines too. There have been accusations in recent years of the FAA being laxer about how it deals with airlines, been more of the reports. And, you know, the FAA had said, look, rather than being as punitive as we used to be, we'd rather just kind of work more closely. And this, some of this, by the way, dates back to the Obama administration. It's not all new. You know, but yeah. So that is a question here. All kinds of things in the world have become politicized that weren't previously politicized. And, you know, in the past, and Andy kind of made this point about the FAA here following the other civil aviation authorities. I mean, in the past, the rest of the world kind of looked to the FAA. The FAA would typically act first. You know, whether the suspicions on the part of the other countries were that, you know, the FAA had some kind of other motivation and that's why they acted first. The reports that Ethiopia or Ethiopian Airlines wants to send the black boxes not to the NTSB in the U.S., but to United Kingdom authorities. You know, the NTSB is kind of this famously apolitical, you know, just investigators who generally are regarded as doing a very good job. So we don't know all the answers yet.
Well, we know that the CEO of Boeing talked to President Trump on Tuesday and really urged him not to ground the planes. What do we know about what Boeing and the FAA are saying about the safety of these planes?
Right, and they were both standing by the safety of the planes as late as Wednesday morning, right? And then Boeing immediately after President Trump said what he did, said that, you know, they were now in agreement. Yeah, I mean, all of that is certainly when you see the president, you know, making that announcement, as opposed to just sort of, like I said, the people who are, you know, the scientists, basically, that's not going to help, you know, with the idea that this was somehow politicized. You know, obviously, we don't know what went on in those conversations. We don't know what kind of, you know, what kind of pressure was or wasn't put on other people. But I think without knowing the answers, I think they're fair questions.
And we've heard from lawmakers, Senator Elizabeth Warren, who said, quote, serious questions have been raised about whether these planes were pressed into service without additional pilot training in order to save money. Can we make any of those connections?
Well, the accusation is that following the Lion Air crash, pilots basically said, look, we didn't know that this could necessarily happen. We didn't know. Some of them say they didn't really even know about the system. And just to explain briefly, there had been crashes in the past, famous crashes. Some listeners might remember the Colgan Air crash near Buffalo, Colgan flying for what was then Continental, flying as Continental Express, or the Air France Flight 447 crash off of Brazil, off the coast of Brazil. Those were crashes where pilots, in a panic when they thought the plane was stalling, did the opposite of what they're supposed to do. I think those of us who aren't pilots would think, oh, you should try to climb, right, to stop the plane from stalling. Actually, you're supposed to tilt the nose down.
And we have to pause right there. Seth Kaplan with us, aviation journalist with Kaplan Research. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this in a minute on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, talking about how dozens of countries have grounded the Boeing 737 MAX jets following the crash of an Ethiopian Airlines flight Sunday. U.S. now following suit. Here's Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut on All Things Considered.
Right now, there is more than ample reason for airline passengers to be greatly concerned, in fact, justifiably frightened about the safety of these airplanes and the ability of pilots to handle a malfunction.
What do you think of the FAA's recommendation that these jets remain on the ground? Are you worried to the point where you've canceled a flight? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Seth Kaplan is an aviation journalist with Kaplan Research. He stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Diane joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Yes, good morning. My question is there a way for the pilot to turn off all automated systems so that he is truly captain of the ship and flying the plane manually?
So can we turn off automated systems, Seth?
Yeah, it's all a question of degree. So much is automated now that that, you know, no, I mean, even the stick, sort of the most manual thing, now it's just that it sort of looks more like, oh, let's say a joystick, if you picture an old video game, than the old manual yoke. So no way to completely disable everything. That said, yeah, absolutely. Pilots can fly a plane much more manually at times, and they do, when depending on conditions, traffic, and the rest of it. Aviation has generally gotten safer as it has become more automated. So on one hand, you can understand right now why people are concerned about all this automation. You know, on the other hand, generally speaking, even counting these crashes, just on a per capita basis, far fewer people die in airplane crashes now, thanks largely to all of the technology over the years. So you wouldn't want to get away from all of it, except at those moments when pilots do need to take over. This does show that there's such a thing as perhaps too much innovation, at least in narrow senses. The 737 MAX, by the way, an airplane that in many regards was not this great leap forward. You know, it was an update to those 737s that we've all flown, new engines, some other minor modifications, but this system, clearly a big change that's now at least partly to blame for one crash and perhaps for the second crash too.
Diane, thanks for the call. Let's go to Vern now, joining us from Boyd. Vern, hi. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I spent 4 years in the Air Force, and I worked on the F-4C and the C-130 and KC-135, whatever. But the point is, when he has trouble taking off and he can't maintain his proper angle of attack, there's something wrong with the sensors on the wings. It's not telling the true airspeed of the wings. And if he doesn't have enough altitude diving down, you're going to hit the ground. So, you know, the sensor probably is a problem. It may be due to atmospheric problems, which I won't go into. It's long and complex. They changed engines. They're hiding the engine designs. It's CMF 56 International.
Well, Vern, let's get Seth here to chime in on that. Could this be a sensor issue?
Yeah, and it sounds like that's exactly what it was with the Lion Air crash. Basically, the plane, I explained earlier about the system that's designed to prevent pilots from making this mistake that pilots in the past had made when a plane seems to be stalling. But that last part that I just said is the key, and it goes to what the caller was getting to, that if the plane thinks it's stalling and it's not, it would be like a bad speedometer in a car, let's say, well, then that system is designed to indeed tilt the nose down, which would help the plane actually regain airspeed if it was in a stall. But then if the plane doesn't pick up that, okay, now it has enough speed, that nose is just going to stay down, and eventually you're going to crash. And that's rather clearly what happened with the Lion Air crash, and the pilots were unable to override the system, seemingly, and perhaps what happened here, too.
Where does Boeing go from here? Do you think it will consider decommissioning these planes?
Well, look, they've got 5,000 orders for these planes, so there's a lot riding on this, on getting this right, obviously, for them. If you ask me to guess, just kind of looking back, you know, taking the long view and imagining, you know, kind of looking back at things that happened decades ago and imagining us looking back at this decades from now, you know, I'm going to guess that they're going to be able to fix this. The FAA did mandate them before it grounded the planes. It said you have to fix this, and that was kind of the strange line that the FAA was walking. It said you need to make an urgent fix, but the planes are still safe. Now, of course, they've been grounded. My guess is that they'll get this right. This is a plane that airlines generally want for, you know, just for other reasons, economics and passenger comfort and all the rest of it. But right now, they're in a bad spot. I mean, there's not going to be, after the Lion Air crash, they still got other orders. You know, airlines were willing to give them a pass and sort of accept the explanation that the airline in that case was at least partly to blame, which it seemed to have been. I mean, by keeping that airplane in the air after the problems appeared. But after this one, people are thinking lightning doesn't strike twice, right, in the same place. And we're not going to see another order for these. So the pressure's on them to fix it. My guess is that they will, and we'll look back from this decades. Look back on this decades from now as, you know, a successful aircraft program that had a tragic start. But that's on them to prove that.
Do you see these fixes, urgent fixes, as technical ones, or is there training issues here as well for pilots?
Probably both, because you know, now they're going to some degree have to basically make the system less aggressive. Right. So first, you had the system that was designed to automate, you know, the prevention of crashes like those that had happened in the past. But you had pilots saying they didn't understand the system. Now, Boeing and airlines have gone out and told the pilots that the system exists and, you know, how to override it. Well, now they're going to have to understand that whatever changes are made, if the system again becomes less aggressive, well, now you can't expect that the system is going to engage in exactly the same way. I'm saying this obviously not knowing exactly what changes they're going to make, but it would be something along that order. So yeah, some software changes, it sounds like mostly. I mean, they're going to have to look into why they're getting the bad airspeed readings too, you know, although that alone should not cause a crash. I mean, it usually takes a confluence of a number of things going wrong to cause a crash. And then, yeah, once they fix all of that, making sure that airlines and pilots understand what they've done, because it might be a little more like the old days in terms of how you fly this this plane again in some subtle ways.
So getting back to this Ethiopian Airlines crash, black boxes are in Paris this morning. What is the timeline for getting to the bottom of this?
The fortunate thing, if you could even use that word when you're talking about tragedy, is that this crash did happen on land. You have a debris field, the black boxes they found, you know, within about a day. This is not going to long remain one of the world's great aviation mysteries. You know, this is not Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 anniversary of that. It was the 5-year anniversary just last week, and we still don't know, you know, what happened there. You know, this is one that the full investigation will probably take a couple of years, but here, we already know a lot now within the first week, and I think in the coming weeks we're gonna understand a lot more about what happened here. That's what happened with Lion Air. It didn't take long. You know, here we are 4.5 months later, and you know, there's some information still to be learned, but we kind of know what happened with that crash, and I think we're kind of going to know what happened with this one before too long.
But you say that full investigation, full reports take a long time to come out.
They do. They tend to take, just off the top of my head, I'd say an average of a couple of years.
So it might be a while. Well, Seth, thank you so much for joining us and filling us in on the details.
Thank you, Kate. A pleasure.
Seth Kaplan there. He is an aviation journalist with Kaplan Research, talking about the crash of the Ethiopian Airlines 737 MAX 8, now grounded as well in the United States, 50 other countries as well. Just ahead, HIV has been reportedly cured in a man researchers are calling the London patient. We'll talk with a researcher, a UW pathologist, about what this means for people living with HIV. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.